You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the I Dig It Podcast,
a podcast where we talk about the student perspective of navigating the world of archaeology and anthropology.
I'm your host, Michaela.
And I'm your host, Alyssa. It's always so awkward, like, starting up an episode, because it's just like, hey there, how's it going? Welcome to this episode.
That's great.
Just like use that. And exactly. I'm just going to use that. Today we have a guest, Liz Quinlan, who is currently a Marie Curie early stage researcher completing a PhD in archaeology at the University of York in zooarchaeology. And so hello there, Liz. How's it going?
Hi. It's going pretty okay, considering that I'm locked in a quarantine hotel in Belgium.
Well, the lighting looks great in your hotel, so
thank you.
It that's is, nice, at least.
There's like a really leafy like courtyard behind me, which has been very conducive to doing work, which is nice.
Oh, that's nice.
That's awesome. So what are you there for and how long?
So I am here to do the first leg of a data collection trip that I was supposed to have done last year because pandemic. Mm-hmm. Basically, a month ago, we got like permission for me to go do things. And then I just started scrambling and emailing people and being like, can I have bones? Thank you. I will be in your country on this date. So the whole trip starts here in Brussels and I'm supposed to be working at the, Natural Science Museum here in Brussels that is currently under review, cause guidelines are changing all the time. So there's some fun uncertainties at the moment, but more certain is my work in the Netherlands, which later in June, I'm going to be moving to The Hague. I have to quarantine there again, but less time. And then I will be spending a month between June and July going to 15 different archaeological depots, museums, and universities, collecting archaeological samples from PhD work, driving around in a car, and frankly, collecting things.
Wow. That's so exciting that you're able to do all this finally, move around a bunch. Yeah. Wow. Trying to catch up. Catch up to all the things we didn't get to do last year.
it's especially good that because I was supposed to. So you mentioned at the beginning that I am a Marie Sklodowska Curie researcher, and so basically it means that I have a grant from the European Commission, and it's like a big network of people. There's 15 of us who are working towards PhDs, and our work kind of intersects a little bit, but the foundation of the MISCA and the Marie Curie, you know, the Marie Sklodowska Curie actions are that it's supposed to have mobility for young researchers working across Europe, going all over the place, doing amazing stuff. And of course, that all got incredibly cut off during the pandemic. So all of us were supposed to have done secondment positions at different universities across Europe, and none of it really happened. We were all kind of like stuck in our home countries, our host countries. And so now I'm finally able to, technically I am, though I am in Belgium, I'm based at the University of Groningen in the Northern Netherlands, because that's my secondment institution. So I am currently on secondment there, at least on paper, to make the European Commission project manager happy. I hope she does the podcast.
Is that position related to the actual PhD, or is it kind of like a parallel thing?
So it's actually the reason I have the PhD. They're the same thing. Basically the deliverable of this job position is my PhD.
Awesome.
So it's a job I'm hired as. I'm in the UK on a work visa, which makes things a little difficult because I can't extend that, whereas students can have arguments for extensions because of COVID, but I can't. So I'm really locked into my deadlines. So, but on the other hand, it means I get paid. So that's nice. Yeah. So we were all hired as researchers. These were advertised as jobs, and we get to do our work, which is wonderful.
So in that sense, the PhD is fully funded because you're being paid to do the work?
Yeah, the PhD is fully funded. Wow. We also have research budgets, and it's kind of like insane, like coming from the US and Canada systems, where, because I did my undergraduate at the University of Toronto and my master's work at UMass Boston. So I'm very firmly... Sorry?
So did my friend Jocelyn. She just
graduated. Oh, Jocelyn Lee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We know each other.
We know each other. Yeah, we've worked together on several things. We're in, she came in the year, her first year was my last year, but overlapped and we know each other.
We're in the same cohort now at Stanford, so
that's why. Nice.
Excellent. Yeah.
Full circle.
So cool. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, Dawson's great.
Amazing.
I, coming from like the US, having this experience with like archaeology is not funded. Who are you talking about? Like, what are you, crazy? Or like having, you know, basically what you can get is like a stipend from your university, and then maybe if your PI is like super famous, you get an NSF grant. Like, and those are like the big deals, like a winter grant. Like, those are, you know, you have to try real hard. Which, of course, not to say that my supervisors didn't try really hard. Like, so the network I'm part of is called Sea Changes, and we're all working on, as you might guess from the name, marine and some freshwater mammals and fish, and looking and also turtles, looking at human environment interaction using a bunch of species as models. So we have people who are, like, the really cool thing is we have people who are not archaeologists working on this. We have ecologists and conservation people, biologists, ichthyologists, and then like me, I'm just an archaeologist who likes bones. And I somehow like convinced people to hire me. But it's really cool because our projects kind of intersect. Me and my colleague Katrin Dirks, who is Belgian and is also here in Belgium, but at her parents' house, she's working on flatfish. We're both based in York, and we have like a shared like pilot study site and stuff like that. Whereas other people are working on sea turtles and walruses and sperm whale teeth for scrimshaws, and we're doing ancient DNA work and stable isotope work and zooms and all sorts of cool stuff. So it's like this massive, amazing, interconnecting network of funded positions with salaries and like research budgets and travel budgets that just, there's no framework like it in the US. And so the European Union, I'm literally down the street from European Parliament right now, and I'm just going to be like, hey, I love you. if I look down the street, I can see it. Like, hello, thank you for the money.
My wallet loves you.
Loves you so much.
I'm going to get a wallet that has a little heart, you in it.
Yeah, basically.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little about the process of like how you found this specific job position after graduating from your master's and what that was like.
Sure. Twitter.
Wow. Very love social media.
Yeah. So Twitter. So I'm very active on Twitter at Archeoliz on Twitter. Perhaps too active. and one of the ways I found out about it was, I mean, I'd heard a lot of chatter about it in the Zoark world because it was like a big deal. Very not often funded Zoark things. And I had seen it on like one of the couple of listservs and on Twitter. And then I saw, so my supervisor, David Orton, he is also a Twitter friend of mine. I've been friends with him on Twitter longer than he's been my supervisor. And the same with my other supervisor. So both my supervisors follow me on Twitter. So David had posted about it, and I was originally supposed to do my master's at York in England, because they have, you know, a zooarchaeology master's. I was going to go do that and then maybe get folded into a PhD after that. I was going to work on David's rat project. That was like the thing I was going to do. But then my father got lung cancer and very rapidly declined. And I had gotten into UMass Boston. I'm from Massachusetts. I was living there with my dad. And I for a variety of reasons, needed to stay. And so I kind of declined the York offer and went to UMass. Had a wonderful time. Unfortunately, my dad, the spiteful man he was, I had a complicated relationship with him, but spiteful man he was, died just before my program started. So I could have gone. But you're like, you don't want to laugh, but like, it's very funny. Nothing if not a sense of timing. But if I didn't do my 2-year master's at UMass, I never would have been right at a great position to apply for this PhD. So basically, like I said, they were advertised. One great place to look at if people are interested in looking at these types of European-based funded opportunities is EU Access. It's just like a website. You can also look on like literally find a PhD, which sounds like it's not legit, but is. And yeah, because a lot of these are required to be publicly shared and published, and you have to share them widely. You can't just have kind of like internal candidates like some places. But yeah, so, and basically from there, it's just kind of contacting the supervisors. Usually they're networks of like 11 to 16 to even 20 PhDs, and they all might be on very different things. When I was looking at this one, you know, I immediately ruled out some of them because I was like, I have never looked at DNA in my life, let alone know how to interpret it. So that's not. It's funny. I put in like, because they asked us to put in like little like interest things first, and then, you know, it wasn't like the full like application. And I put in for a couple of them, and I like very desperately, because I really wanted to do the COD one, which my friend Lulu is doing, and like, but it's DNA. And I was just like, I said some like nonsense about like, like an amateur's eye could help the blah 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 blah. And it was like, yeah, no. They just laughed and were like, no.
At least you tried.
I had applied for a couple different PhDs within the network, and I was offered the one that I currently am on, which is on Atlantic salmon. So that's what my PhD is about. It is about tracking declines in exploitation of Atlantic salmon during the medieval period based around the North Sea basin area. Mm-hmm. So that's my whole project.
Wow, that's awesome.
And that's so cool.
I love salmon.
I do too, although the more I research into salmon fishing and farming, the less I love salmon.
You're like,
Like wild salmon, great. Farmed,
not so much. Yeah, I've also been looking into like microplastics a lot lately too, which is making me like ocean
go
food
vegan
a little less. Yeah, I'm sure there's microplastics in our vegetables too at this point.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So that's awesome. That's really cool. It's crazy how everything's so connected. Like, because our friend Theo was working with, what was his name in the ZooArc department?
David Orton.
Yeah, I think she was working with him on his fish project while we were there at York.
On the rat project?
Oh, rat. Yeah, the rat.
Yeah. Ones. Oh, yeah.
So, not fish project. Talking about fish.
I was like, David hasn't done fish. Well, he did do cod. That was another possibility.
Yeah, I remember her talking about her tedious days in the lab, like sorting out bones. And yeah, so sounds awesome. Crazy, all connected. That sounds really cool, though.
Yeah, also, like, every ZooArc, like, knows each other, because, although there's, like, so, it's funny, there's so many new people, because there are now people who are doing, like at York, like, programs that are, you know, specifically targeted towards it, and Sheffield, which, save Sheffield Archaeology, that's my political statement there, save Sheffield. If listeners are not aware, Sheffield Archaeology, the department, just got basically, like, a super whiplash, decision to basically be like defunded and made redundant. It hasn't been fully decided yet, but they have one of the first of all best archaeology programs in the world, and then also specifically zooarchaeology, they have a fantastic program. But yeah, like places like Sheffield and York, which have kind of, you know, masters that are, you know, just zooarchaeology, that wasn't happening 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So now you just have this plethora of people who are zooarchaeologists, and it's amazing. Whereas before, people kind of stumbled into it. Like even I kind of stumbled into it. I was doing Paleolithic, like lithics work in archaeology in my undergrad. And then in my last year, I took a zooarch course and I was like, well, this is my life now. but before that, it was kind of just like, I had a crazy old supervisor who had some bones in his closet. And now I'm a zooarchaeologist. Like that was kind of like the pathway.
But during the quarantine, were you in York or were you in?
Yeah. So during the lockdowns, I had been in York. I moved to York in September of 2019 with an auspicious start on the last Thomas Cook flight out of New York.
So oh my God.
Thomas Cook is an airline an airline company in the UK, very famous for like cheap tickets, packages. It had been going for like hundreds of years, and they like folded over a weekend. They declared bankruptcy on a Sunday at like 8 p.m. and I was like supposed to be on a plane. So I was waiting at JFK, and then we were all waiting and we couldn't check in, and the people at the Thomas Cook like check-in area were confused about what was going on. They were like, we've just been told we can't check you in, we're waiting, like we're sorry, hold on like a few minutes. Like we've been waiting there for like an hour and a half. And finally, people from like the British embassy showed up, and because it was mostly British people returning. They didn't care about me. Like they cared about like the time because I was going into Manchester. Yeah. So there was a lot of Scots who were returning, and they were just like, they came in, and this like very efficient British woman like was just like, we are going to get you all home. And I was like, what is happening? Like I thought like a terrorist attack had happened.
Oh,
like
I was, oh, like, that's terrifying. And
I like looked on Twitter and it was like, Thomas Cook declares bankruptcy. Like, oh, cool.
That makes sense.
How am I gonna get to England?
How did you get to England?
Yeah, and it had been like super scramble last minute to get there because my program was starting on October 1st. I defended my master's thesis on September 12th. And although it was kind of funny because at that point, like obviously I worked extremely hard on my master's and, you know, it was a lot of work, but they couldn't really say like, no, you don't pass because I was like, on a plane to go to a PhD, which they had already started bragging about.
Like, I was like, ooh, like, by the way, we're actually not going to do this for you.
And like, well, because it looked very good to like, they were talking to like, you know, the wider school, and they were saying, look, we've produced, you know, people who are going to PhDs. And it was Melissa, my friend, who was going to St. Louis, and I was going to England, and they were like, all this stuff. And I'm like, you really can't tell us we can't pass.
We've already been accepted. Like, what's going to happen if you don't pass us? Yeah.
You've already dropped
us. Used us for clout.
Yeah. First of all, how dare you even think about not passing?
Yeah. But it was really funny because one of my committee members had read the wrong version of my thesis.
Oh, so no.
My entire, like, talk back afterwards, which, like, we had, like, so at UMass, we have, like, a presentation, which is supposed to be, like, 20 minutes. I went for, like, 35, because why not? I had a lot to say. And then you have, like, a public comment and question period, and then you go in another room, and they chat about you, and then you come back, and you chat together. You go away, and they chat again, and then they're like, hey, you did it. Or they're like, you suck. Those are the options. But I came in to talk with my committee, and like I found out that one of them, who shall not be named, but like most people can probably guess who it is if they knew who was on my committee, had printed out the wrong version and was like, well, I have some questions about, there's sections that don't seem to be complete, blah blah blah. And I was like, what happened? Like, did I forget stuff? And then I noticed that the version he had, all of the figures, because I had done this on purpose, all of the figures were photos of cats and dogs. So I had done that on purpose so that, like, if he, who I thought would do that, had done what I thought he would do and just print out a random version, it would be obvious, but apparently that was not enough. And so it was like one of my committee members just looked at him with like utter disgust and was like, I cannot believe you.
Oh my God.
I would love to see those pages. If you could like screenshot some of them, yeah. That would be great. I will send it. That would be like, so fun to post.
It was like my grandmother's cat and like my dog.
This isn't the one that you're supposed to be reading.
Yeah, but the thing is they had like the right figure like description. So it was like figure one shows a comparative analysis of blah, 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 blah. And then it's like a cute pup.
That is a comparative analysis, yes.
Yeah, I don't know what of, but certainly not this. yeah, so like that was like the hectic environment that led to me like coming to the UK. And then I got to the UK, I was like starting, everything was great, it was going well. I had been back in January to like visit people. And then like March, my partner had come to visit in mid-March of 2020. So like, we'd all been hearing this news, like, oh, it's like there's this, you know, coronavirus thing kind of going on. But yeah, who is she? We don't know. And then my partner was leaving on March 16th, I think. And that was like when the UK was making their decisions about shutting down airports. And so kind of we were just like, okay, you need to leave. So he left. And then the next week, I still have like a smug satisfaction that I like took all of my stuff home because I got all my stuff and I left. And everyone in my lab was like, what are you doing? Like, why are you taking like your computer home? And I was like, because I don't think we're going to be back for a while. And they were like, I think that's a little alarmist, Liz. You're being catastrophizing a little bit. And then on March 19th, it was like, hey, fuckos, you need to leave now.
Look who catastrophized it in the end.
That's how my situation was too, because I was living in Cambodia right when the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. And people in Southeast Asia obviously were like freaking out because they could see like what was happening. And then I was there on a research grant and the research grant people were like, no, it's fine. Like just stay there. You're at like a level zero risk right now. And I was like, no, you don't understand. It's like getting bad. And so they didn't allow me to fly home, but I did anyway. And then 5 days after I got home, they called everyone to come home. And I was like, oh. I told you. You didn't.
What did I say?
What did I say? It's like, we know better because we're like on the ground. We can like see what's happening. But
yeah. But yeah, it just like everything went from like I had like five, six months to like make friends. And then boom, pandemic. And I was in York. So I'd been in York the whole time. This is the first time I've left England because I'm currently in Belgium. Up until May, I hadn't actually left the city limits of York. In May, I like took myself to a little cottage in the Yorkshire Moors and like locked myself away.
That sounds so nice, though.
It was very nice. It was like a nice writing retreat. But yeah, I was in York the whole time. I couldn't go into the lab. So I was supposed to have in spring and summer of 2020, I was supposed to have gotten all of my laboratory training done and all of my data collection. None of that happened. And so I was not like approved. I couldn't go into the lab. So I didn't get back into BioArc, which is our lab area, until August of 2020. So from March to August, I was just at home and I had whatever I had with me. And it was not a great time because, like many people, fell into a deep depression. There was a lot of contributing factors, but like pandemic was the big one.
Yeah.
And it was like, I recently had to fill out this thing for our grant manager, being like talking about like our progress up to now. And obviously they were like, we want to know about how the pandemic has affected people. And there was another question, which was like, what issues have you had with your project aside from COVID? And I was like, I don't think I can separate any of them because anything
they're all related
since March or early, honestly February, because we were having issues like getting in February. I was like, I cannot separate out the like, I and like some of the way it was worded was like, now that the pandemic is over, I was like, it's not over. Like,
very much not.
I'm extremely fortunate that I'm fully vaccinated because I have pre-existing health conditions, but my partner didn't have a vaccine, didn't have a dose up until last week. And I wasn't going to do anything that was going to put him in danger. I don't want to do anything that's going to put other people in danger. I've been following all the rules. I've been, you know, following more than some of the rules in the UK because they've gotten a bit lax at times, and people were just like schlepping across the country. And, you know, then we had huge case rises, and I was like, well, I could have told you that. I don't like saying I told you so because people are dying, but it's just been like, unlike many have said, an overwhelming time. But I have spent most of the time working on, well, attempting to work on a massive review paper, which has gotten more massive as the weeks go by.
In a good way or bad way?
Way, like, it's definitely a good thing. It's just, I think, turned into a monster that neither of my supervisors knew it was going to turn into when they were like, you should do a review paper. Like, while you can't do any other work. And I was like, yeah, great. And then, now it's just huge.
It's a book now, not just a paper.
I mean, it's I just hit over 1,000. Well, I'm at 1,200 sites reviewing data from, and like, it's insane. I've never worked with a data set this big. I like want to cry all the time when I open up Excel. I have learned how to use R, like as much as anyone ever learns how to use R. Like, uh-huh. I Google a ton of stuff and then cry, and then I take a breath, and then I'm really happy, and I ride that high for like a week.
I can relate so hard to that. I took my first R class last term. Most of it was just crying, and then I like made a map, and I was like, "Oh, that's so cool! I'm never touching this again."
Yeah, that like elation when you make a map. And like the worst part is, not the worst part, and it's not his fault, David, my wonderful supervisor, he's just really good at R. He's very intuitively good at programming. So I don't think he always gets the like, when those of us who are dummies are like, look, I made a map. And he's like, great.
Congratulations.
Like, please.
I'm fine.
It took me so long.
It's like, oh, if you would have done this, it would have been like 2 seconds. It's like, well, no.
It's like, please, no. Just like, he's like, obviously like, no, good job.
Like, okay. It's like, just give me a pat on the back, please. Please affirm me.
And it was funny because I was saying it to someone else who's like an established PI, but also like is very open about it. She's like, I hate R. It's hard. And like, she was like, yeah, it's like a high. It's better than drugs. that good figure. And I'm like, thank you. This is the mentorship we all need.
Yeah. Amazing.
I've never looked at R, never touched R, but I've just heard horror stories about it, and I'm okay without ever looking at it in my life.
It's a great programming tool. Like, it's a
apparently
fantastic.
It's very useful to know how to do.
It's, and I have gotten to a point now where I have found myself saying, "Oh, I can do this easier in R," and then doing a thing, and it was easier. So I've like crossed that part of that difficulty. There's still plenty of stuff that it's like, I don't freaking know what this is talking about. But it is obviously like, it's like learning a new language. Shocking.
And we'll be right back after this break. And welcome back from the break. Something I've been curious about, Liz, is how did you get started in archaeology? What was your main interest that got you in?
So I think one of the things that I'd always been kind of interested in like history in general. I was like, you know, there was a post going around on Twitter a couple of days ago, which was like, all you kids who got this Egyptology book are all, you know, gay and into history. And I was like, true. and it was, but yeah, I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I got all sorts of, you know, like ancient Greece and ancient Egypt books and, you know, all those stuff. I did really well in history, loved all of that. And I, in high school, actually, I had kind of a non-traditional end to my high school. I was in like an alternative school situation for I had to repeat my final year because I had been sick. And so I had the opportunity to take like college courses at one of the local community colleges. So I ended up taking anthropology, like cultural anthropology, and also like a, I think one of them was like quotidian life in the ancient Greek world or something. And I really enjoyed them. I thought they were great. I was interested in kind of classic stuff, but also I really liked the anthropology. So I decided at that point I wanted to, you know, either major or minor in anthropology of some kind, whether that be cultural anthropology or something different. I kind of had, you know, some scattered ideas and thoughts, but I was also really interested in theater at the time. So actually when I did my undergrad, the first place I did my undergraduate degree, I was there for about 3 months first and then left because it was not the place for me. It was Marist College in New York, and it's up the street from Vassar. So I could have been at Vassar, but I wasn't. It's a Catholic university that is secular now, ostensibly. And there are definitely some very good parts to it, but like when I got there and I found out that like the Campus Democrats group was like 2 years old in like 2011, I was like, oh, I don't think this is the place for me. But there I was majoring in, theatrical play in playwriting and in cultural anthropology. Like those are what I was studying. But I started kind of becoming really interested in archaeology at the time. I was very active on Tumblr. And I was interested in anthropology. And I was interested in like the anthropology. I was in, there was a thriving anthropology and archaeology community on Tumblr of all places. And I kind of started to like, you know, talking with people and learning more things. And I was like, I really like archaeology because it means I don't have to go out and do ethnography and deal with alive people. So that was kind of like my, I was like, you mean I can deal with just bones or like just like stuff? And of course, there's way more complex things. Of course, you know, doing archaeology, we're also dealing with modern populations and descent communities and stuff like that. So clearly my views on the subject have evolved. But, you know, when I was like a little shitty 18-year-old, I was like, I don't want to deal with alive people, like, which is insane considering the fact that I do so much science communication work and like I love it.
So many alive people.
Yeah. So that's kind of how that happened. Then I applied for, I was looking at a couple different places, for archaeology, and I also really wanted to get as far away from Boston as possible. Except without going to California, cause I just didn't really want to do that. No offense, it's okay. To California. It's fine. So my little sister did that. So I couldn't like do that as well. Understand. Like we couldn't both be in California. So I went to Toronto, and I went to University of Toronto and I did my undergrad. I got an honors bachelor's of arts in anthropology, but it was an archaeology specialist, with a minor in sexual diversity studies. So that was my like undergrad education journey, like how we got to that point.
I was going to like ask him, like, how was it going from like US to Canada and then back to US? But if you had majored in anthropology in Canada, because I thought it was going through like is archaeology and anthropology separated in Canada? Or are they?
No, it's the same. It's North America still. So like the four field approach, like is very much, a thing. And like U of T has always been very like, because it has a very old anthropology program, it's always been kind of like on the same wavelength as like Chicago and Stanford and Harvard and stuff in terms of like changes in the field. So yeah, it was anthropology. Although I found out actually that I could have switched to an archaeological sciences BSc, but I didn't know that. I didn't have a very good undergrad advisor, so I didn't know. Because I was taking most like archaeological science courses, but I did take a couple more anthropology focused courses because it was required for the degree, because you couldn't just do archaeology. You also had to have this balance, which I think is really good. And that's something that I do find that UK undergrads are missing. it's a thing. And I teach UK undergrads, and, you know, through my work, I try to, you know, change that. And there are definitely people who are trying to inflect more theoretical grounding and anthropology type stuff into the work, but they're also limited by the, you know, programs. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to have gone from undergrad in Canada, which honestly, the really only difference between Boston and Toronto is like the weather a bit, and, you know, that the like that it's there's not a lot of cultural, there's some cultural differences. They have better Indian food, but like that kind of, it's not like, you know, going to Siberia. It's not a big cultural difference. There's definitely more of a cultural difference between the US and the UK. Although I still find myself like, because Boston and growing up in Boston and being in New York quite a lot, I have like a very like Northeast upbringing, and that's like my cultural upbringing in the US. And now I live in the Northeast of England. And it's a very similar vibe in that, you know, like my family comes from like a history of kind of like working class Northeasterners. And a lot of the people I'm surrounded with in the countryside in Yorkshire, same deal. So I get the politics of here. I get the values and the cultural values of the area. So that hasn't been as much of a change, but like, there's definitely some like insane things that English people do that I'm like, are you like this?
Yeah. My next question was going to be about like the integration of like going from the US over to England, but it's a little same, a little normal. Is having it kind of like having that like kind of bond with like this working class being in the Northeast and then being in England, does that help like any, what's the word I'm looking for? Homesickness of any sort.
I mean, it probably would if I experienced any homesickness for the US. I don't. Yeah, well, not even that. I don't really have a home in the US. So both my parents are, all of my grandparents are dead. Most of my aunts and uncles are gone. It's kind of me and my sisters. And they live in California, Virginia, and Massachusetts. So when I go visit, I have to like pick two states or like pick one. And so I don't really have like a place to go back to, which is fine. Like people get kind of weepy about that, especially English people. They get very weepy about the idea that I'm not going home for Christmas. And I'm just like, it's not a big deal, man. Like it's a, and like, I'm not into it. And I'm not Christian. So like, and then they're like, what? They're like, ah, you're an atheist. And I'm like, no, I'm not. They can't comprehend. That's not fair to all English people, but like in York specific, like finding, so I'm not Jewish, my partner is. And like, I tried to find a Hanukkah card for my partner and I looked in every card store in York.
Non-existent.
Not a single one. Not a single one. So like, it's so like, they're like, oh, you're white and you're not Christian. What could you possibly be? An atheist. And it's like, no, England. There's so many other things.
That's hilarious. Did you meet your partner out there or where?
No, so my partner is from Pennsylvania originally. Mm. We met in the States. We met in November of 2018. Yes, that seems right.
Because he's been following you around as you hop.
Yeah, well, yeah, so he had been in Boston for quite a while, and we met on OkCupid. And
I met mine on Tinder, so understandable.
Yeah, I have no shame about dating apps. I was like, I had gone on like so many first dates before I met Dan, like, and I was just so sick of it. And I, to be fair, and I tell him this, like, I kind of just like was like, fuck it, and like went on a date with him. Like, he probably wasn't like, his profile wasn't the greatest. He knows that. But I'm really glad I did. And you know, it gives us a lesson, like, ignore, you know, preconceived notions of whatever.
Don't judge a book by its profile.
Yeah. Don't judge a guy by his weird profile pictures. Although there were like dogs in them. So I was like, okay, he's not
all bad.
Terrible. Yeah. So yeah, So he was living in Somerville in Massachusetts, and I was living down in Brockton, with it, which, if anyone is familiar, it's far away. but I was working in Cambridge at Harvard. So like I'd usually like after work, I'd like go hang out. So that wasn't that hard. Although it's really funny because like, if anyone's familiar with Boston traffic, I always said I found out that the drive from his place to my place at like 2 a.m. was 37 minutes. Mm-hmm. But if it was any other time of day, it was like 1 to 2 hours.
Oh my gosh. Traffic.
Because Boston traffic is a nightmare.
Oh no. It's like LA traffic.
Yeah. See, except LA, it's like you're just like flat on a highway, like, and you could just like see everything. Boston is just like you are losing your soul on 95 and just wish you had never been there.
It's like, why am I doing this?
Like, I had more breakdowns on like 93 South than like anywhere else.
Should make a diary, the 93 South.
Which will be. Yeah, it'll be way too relevant for, like, anybody. Like, yeah, that stretch there, that's a good place to have a breakdown. Just crying in your car, stuck in traffic. So, yeah.
Make all your life choices on there.
Yeah.
Being like, yes, should I do this?
To rein that back in, yes, we met in the States. We had been dating for, like, a couple months, like 6 months when I applied for this job. And I was like, I'm not going to get this. This is silly. And then I was like, oh shit. And I was like, and it was weird because we were like, oh crap. Like, okay, we've been dating for 8 months. That's like that's, it's not a year. It's not like what's happening. So we just kind of were like, all right, I guess we'll keep seeing how it goes. And then we had started talking about him potentially coming and moving over here because he was doing a master's at the time at Johns Hopkins online. And it was in applied engineering, and he was not really happy with the program. He had taken a couple interesting courses, but he was just really not happy with it. So he was interested in looking at some other things. And he actually ended up, I was helping him like research, you know, stuff. And he ended up applying and he's doing a master's at Sheffield in solar cell technology. But that's like, and it's like exactly what he wanted to do. So it's funny because people are like, oh, did you just move to follow your girlfriend? And he's like, yeah, but this program is also like exactly what I wanted. So
double yes.
It all worked out. Yes, and like, yes.
Liz is here as a bonus.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's really nice.
Amazing.
But yeah, we lived together in York because like still pandemic. So there was no reason for him to be in Sheffield. He can only go in like once a week. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And he's still in York right now working on, he's writing up his master's stuff now, which is so cool and so much going to save the world, whereas like I'm like, archaeology isn't doing shit.
Let's go.
I'm like, hey, he's trying useful. To like improve the efficiency. He's trying to improve the efficiency of organic solar cells and like is doing like all sorts of cool spectroscopy stuff on perovskite solar cells. And I'm just like, I looked at a bone today.
Hey, we are useful. We can make change. Sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. We're definitely useful. I just sometimes like, oh my god,
you're doing what for the world?
Yeah, I I go through that mental crisis very often. It's like, what am I contributing? Oh, so are you in your second year then of PhD? How long is it supposed to last for?
Yeah, so I'm in my second year. It is a 36-month appointment for my job and a 3-year PhD. So in the UK, the PhDs are 3 years. Because ostensibly you've done all your coursework in your master's. Although I still find myself going, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I've taken a couple, like, I took a couple, like, master's courses and a couple, because I can just take them if I want to. And yeah, but like the idea is that we're supposed to just kind of like start, well, if you don't already have a project, you're supposed to be using the first year to like define your project and then you start. Or if you're like me, they're like, you already have a project, go.
Just do it.
And yeah. And then it's like, oh, just kidding. Here's a pandemic. I just had my like 18-month review, which went not great, but you know, it is what it is. Things are going significantly better now. Yeah. And I have like my next check-in like in September, and then it'll be like my final year. Mm.
Does having a bad review impact anything, or is it just to see where you are and what you need?
No, it's not necessarily like, it wasn't like a progression point or anything. And also, I mean, it's all complicated by the fact that like, because I have a contract and I'm a staff member, it's not like the usual kind of like student progression. But yeah, it was because, you know, I had not been doing as much work as I thought I was going to be able to do. And I was still like really impacted by pandemic stuff. Yeah. And it was kind of like a jolt to my system. And I've been, you know, really throwing myself into collecting. Like, the reason for this whole trip is collecting a bunch of salmon bones that I am going to be taking back to York and doing zooarchaeology by mass spectrometry analysis for species identification and confirmation on, and then also some which I'm going to be bringing back to do kind of a wider isotope analysis study on some of the bigger sites. So the major thing with salmon is that Atlantic salmon, they don't preserve very well in the record. And there's like as many different opinions about why that is as there are zooarchs. Like, it's some people are like, it's the fattiness of the bone, but there's other really fatty bones that like are fine. Yeah. So, and then you'll have sites that have excellent preservation otherwise, like Coppergate, which is in York, which is a site that it's my major large site that I'm looking at. It has excellent preservation. All of the fish look great. Even the salmon look great, but there's just so few, like they're compactually, Coppergate has a ton of salmon. Supposedly it has like over 300. I've been only able to verify 280. And I think it's because some may have gone missing or are like in another box. And I just didn't have time to really track all of them down. But for the most part, I'm working with sites that have like under 10 salmon bones or salmonids. I am working from the opinion and assumption that you cannot tell the difference between them, between salmon and brown trout, based just on morphological identification. There are people who disagree with that. And I'm basically doing my whole project, a component of my project is kind of narrowing down identification protocols. I originally was going to be having a section that was about geometric morphometrics analysis. So using photographs and using a bunch of statistical analysis to tell whether there are significant differences physically between features on vertebral sections of the salmon and trout. Unfortunately, that's like the first thing we had to cut for my project, because I was supposed to be sourcing like 10 wild salmon and 10 wild trout last summer, and none of that happened. So we cut that, but like I'm saving it for like later. Like I might fold it into like post-doc or something, because like my rationale is, hey, you wanted me to do this in the first place, pay me to do it. my whole postdoc application. But yeah, so basically most sites have like one or two bones, maybe 10, maybe 20. And then there's some anomalous sites that have like 100 or 200, but they're super rare, few and far between. Like I said earlier, I was talking about this review that I've been doing. It's a review of North Sea salmonid remains. And basically I've reviewed about 230 archaeological sites that have salmonid remains present. And when I say salmonid, I'm really only referring to salmon and trout. Grayling is one of the other salmonids, and Arctic char are the other salmonids that you would find in the area, and they're distinctive and you can ID them. So those I'm looking at undetermined salmonids. So 230 or so sites that have it, and I'm up to almost 1,000 sites that don't have them. Of those 230 sites, the grand total of salmonid bones in all of Europe, in all of Western Europe, because this review covers Scotland, England, the Netherlands, France, Germany, Belgium, Denmark, Norway, and somewhere else. maybe not. I said Scotland already. But it covers like this whole arc of the North Sea basin area. Mm-hmm. So within that whole arc of the area, there are 1,600 salmonid bones, which is insane.
When you say review, how are you finding which places have these sites? Like, are you just going through papers and searching salmonid, or like, how does that work?
A lot of it is going through papers and searching. Mm-hmm. But I have been very helped by the fact that, so one of our project partners on the Sea Changes Network is James Barrett, who formerly of Cambridge is now in Norway, I think. And he, over the past couple of years, has been working on this. It's not published yet, so I'm not officially doing this work. I am, but it's a survey of the North Seas, and it's basically he's gotten together a bunch of fishbone experts and animal bone experts from countries that are around the North Sea, the Baltic Sea, the Norwegian Sea, and basically asked them to do these big, and they've been working these big reviews of literature, pulling in sites that have fishbone remains. And collecting them into a standardized spreadsheet framework.
That's so nice.
So in some countries, that is easier. So in the Netherlands, oh my God, I love the Netherlands. Everything is so well organized. Everything's uploaded to the central database. Or if it isn't, you can like email someone and find out. Like, it's been super great. Belgium, less so, but there's only like three people who work on fish bones in Belgium, so you can just email one of them. England is a clusterfuck because even like the whole of the UK, because there's two, so there's very few English sites that had been put into this Northern Sea Synthesis review, and then Scottish sites, there are quite a lot, but it's only the sites that Jen Harland has really been working on. So it's been scattered. So I've had to fill in a lot of blanks, and especially England. So I've used two databases commissioned by Historic England. One was by Matilda Holmes, which is on southern fishbone or southern animal bone. And then I had to obviously extract fishbone information out of that. So that took quite a while. And then the other one is Alberella and Pierney, which is on central England. And that one I had to do the same thing of extracting fishbone information out of it. So those were less, they're organized, but less well organized than being able to just kind of like go through and, you know, highlight and copy and paste some information from the other ones. Recently, what I've been doing is finding sites to fill in the blanks, basically, because I'm missing a lot of Northern England. I'm missing a lot of France. I'm missing some of, because unfortunately the French sites, the only ones that have been uploaded to the NSS folders that I have access to are the Roman ones. I don't need Roman. I need medieval. So I've been doing a lot of my own searching through French fishbone reports and just, you know, control F salmon. See if they're mentioned. That's, I've got like 30 or 40 sites that I've manually gone through the actually more than that, because I had to do it for a lot of English sites too, but like 30 or 40 or 50 sites that I've manually gone through and basically like recorded all of the fishbone information into the same type of spreadsheet. And a lot of this I'm doing it in the same spreadsheet, like the standardized spreadsheet for the Northern Sea Synthesis thing, so that eventually when I am like, I would like to publish a review with this technically unpublished review data, I can be like, I did things.
I did
here.
The review.
Look.
And now I'm part of it.
Need to learn how to like write a code that just automatically searches for these things. I'm sure
the
there's ways.
The problem is there's like, there's some I could do it with, but the problem is that so many of them are just tucked into like PDFs and
or like photocopied instead of
like
digitized
and like they're mostly just digitized hard copies, and like everyone records their fish in different ways. Everyone like does everything in different ways. Some people use different species names, not the Latin species, but like some people will be like, I'm just using common names, but like common names are different.
depending on so, where like, you went. Dang.
Yeah, I came over like one of them. I came across one of the most unhinged like reporting methods I've ever seen the other day. I sent like 14 Snapchat videos about it to a friend of mine because I was just like, I cannot comprehend this. Like, why would you do this? And like, at first I was like, was this because it was like punch card recorded? Because I've come across punch card recorded stuff, which obviously because you were punch card recording and you had to feed it in and you know, use a program to read it, it comes out a bit wonky. No, this was in like 1986. Like Excel had been invented.
No excuse.
This is just, it's just awful. It's
plain rude.
How dare.
Yeah. I'm like, I bet this analyst is like dead or retired, so I can't actually.
But if
like,
they're alive, I'm coming for send you. Them a strongly worded email.
Yeah, just get a snarky footnote.
Dear you, you know who you are.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. No, I don't know. It's like, please, just everyone use the scientific names that are listed. Go on Wikipedia if you don't know. There's ways to get this.
Well, the problem is that there's like debate between ichthyologists and stuff. So I have learned this. So my colleague, Katrine, who I mentioned earlier, is working on flatfish. She's like a trained ichthyologist and biologist. She's like named a fish.
Her
recent publication, multiple fish, I think. It's really cool. It's like some kind, I can't remember what it is, but it's some kind of like maybe a cichlid. I'm not sure. Which like, yes, it is. It is. I just Googled it. It's Protomelis krampus. She named it after the Krampus, like the child eating like Christmas story because they eat babies.
That's
like the fish eat their babies.
Such a good name. Oh my
god. So she named it. Protomelis krampus, and it's a Paedophagus cichlid, from like Malawi. So I'm like hyping up her research. That's very amazing. Cool. It's I think her master's research, or like earlier, but like I have learned from her the nightmare that it is about like fish taxonomy and like how people just don't agree about it. This is why there's so few fish specialists who are zooarchs, because fish are just horrible. Because no one can agree like the species, no one can agree like any of it. Like for salmonids, for salmon is salmosalar. Brown trout is salmotruta. Some people call sea trout, which is a morph of brown trout that are anadromous, so they go out to the sea and come back. Some people call them by a different species name, but some people just call them salmotruta. So like there's like a bunch of disagreement. So another thing that complicates my like review collection is that I have to have a category for every single like reference in the literature of like, so I have like columns that are just like salmosalar, salmocfsalar, salmosalar/salmotruta, salmotruta cf salmosalar, salmotruta ferio something. And I'm like, what the hell?
Sounds like you're trying to like summon some demon or something. This giant salmon just apparates.
Yeah. And when I'm like in R, like melting and casting all of that data to try and like make it into a readable format, I have to include all of those as ID variables. And I'm like, I am going to summon something. I don't know what.
Giant fish just appears.
Giant salmon monster.
A giant salmon comes and just slaps me in the face. There's like a GIF that I can find that I like use on Twitter quite often, and it's like a salmon jumping out of the water and slapping a guy in the face. Oh, and I'm like, this was my whole PhD.
This is my life.
We have so much good content for your Instagram for this episode. Can't wait.
We can animate you getting slapped by a salmon too if you want.
We'll just post your face on that GIF.
I was like,
have like a dramatic photo, like, oh no. With a little, like a little fin.
I love it.
Amazing.
Love it.
Amazing. Can't wait. All right. Well, I think it is time we wrap up. that was such a great conversation. And thank you so much, Liz, for joining us. I never knew I wanted to hear so much about salmon, but I'm glad I did. And I'm super excited.
People say that a lot to me. And I think that I am very negative about the salmon, but I'm glad that I'm coming off.
You make it very entertaining. Oh, yeah. So
I've learned a lot about salmons and how to.
I'm going to put that on my CV. Yes. Is entertaining about salmon.
And how to summon salmons as well. Use that yes, next D&D yes. Yeah.
Oh, a good idea.
I've got an idea. Oh, I've got an idea for a character. A salmon.
Yes. We all have salmon summoners.
We gotta draw it and make it come to
now,
life.
What circle would that be in the druidic circles? Because they're like a circle of fish.
Instead of casting fireball, you can cast salmon ball, and it's just a giant ball of salmons. Yeah,
great. Or they're like little sushis.
Yeah,
little maki bowls.
And then when you're like hand to hand combat, you're just slapping somebody with the fish.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, okay, weird side note. In Brussels, they're obsessed with poke. I don't know why. There are 40 poke
as
restaurants
they should
in
be.
Brussels.
Poke is what? Amazing.
It was like cool like 4 years ago.
I wonder it's if they're good. I wonder if they're like Japanese run or Hawaiian run at all, or if it's just like random Brussels people.
We like fish.
Random like, Brussels sprouts like running a
poke. I was on like Deliveroo, which is the delivery like app.
Oh,
and I was like looking for I was looking for specifically like African restaurants because I was like, oh, I want to have like a Cameroonian restaurant or something. Like that would be really interesting because like there are a lot of people here who are from those areas of the world. And it was just like poke. Like it was like okay, like I could get this back in like Harvard Square yeah. in Cambridge. It's like there's like four poke restaurants.
Oh my God.
Amazing. Ugh. I wouldn't be complaining. I love
like, which poke place am I going to?
Oh no, it's great. And especially considering that I'm coming from like the relatively food. Okay, no, York is not a food desert, but it is like it's a rough
it doesn't have
place.
A lot of
like
sushi.
It's definitely gotten better in the last couple years. But, like, there's a couple places, like, usually I've got, like, a list of places that I go. And, like, that's kind of it. And then even, like, even going to, like, Sheffield, there's so many more options.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, 60, like, delivery places in York.
We would go to Leeds a lot for food stuff. Yeah, sushi and everything.
Yeah. And that's, like, what's been killing me is, like, not being able to travel just, like, in the area so much. Because, like, I'd like to just like go to Leeds and have like dinner, go to Sheffield, have like, you know, whatever, but we're just in York, which is great. Love York. It's, you know, if I have to be stuck in a city, great. I'm defended by medieval walls if I need to be. It's good. But, you know,
yeah,
it is not the capital of England in terms of food.
All right, well, it's so nice talking to you, Liz. Do you have any social media that you want to plug and any lasting thoughts?
I guess.
Yeah.
So my Twitter is at ArchaeoLiz. So ArchaeoLiz. And I also have a Instagram under the same name, but I don't post on it as much. I am not good at the Instagrams. But yeah, and then I think just thank you. That's my like parting thought. This has been a very nice way to spend a night.
And it's finally dark outside.
It's finally dark outside. Especially because I've just been like locked in this hotel room for multiple days.
Well, I hope you're able to get out.
Getting judged by the concierge for just, say I just ordered like fries and chocolate milk. And then the concierge like, kind of laughed at me.
Like, are you okay?
Like, over the phone. He's like, oh, is that all you want? Shut up.
That's all I want.
Like, yes, it is.
Don't
what
judge
if I just, here. What if I just wanted to, you know, supplement it? No, just fries. But
in this economy, fries. Only fries.
This economy, fries.
All right.
Well, thank you both so
much. Thank you for coming. And we'll see you or we'll talk to you all another time. Bye.
show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.